Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the battle against malaria. Every year, more than 1 million people around the world die from the disease. In Africa, more than 2,000 children die from that disease every day. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with Dr. Alan McGill from the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. We'll be talking about the effort to develop a vaccine against malaria, some of the measures that are taken to try to control it and treat it, and also particularly about some concerns now that the deadliest form of the disease is becoming resistant to one of the best drugs used to fight it. And questions and comments, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest. Dr. McGill is director of the Division of Experimental Therapeutics at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. That's in Washington, D.C. He has spent a number of years now working on vaccines and diagnostics and drugs directed against malaria. He's lived and worked in South America, in Africa, and Southeast Asia. He previously served as head of parasitology at the Naval Medical Research Center Detachment in Lima, Peru. Also for 2 years as head of clinical research for the Malaria Vaccine Development Unit at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He's an active member of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, and also is president-elect of the International Society of Travel Medicine. And he's joining us by telephone. And again, questions are certainly welcome. The number here on Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody listening is welcome to call. Dr. McGill, hello.
Well, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for being with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, it's a delight.
The I think perhaps one of the basic questions to start with is to ask you to talk about numbers. I mentioned the death toll from malaria and the numbers of people who have malaria even larger. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people.
Well, that's certainly correct. I think the numbers are always a little difficult to nail down to exactly what the incidence and case rates and death rates are in many of these endemic areas, but certainly tens of millions of cases every year, and the number that's been purported to you has been used is about 1 million deaths every year, but sometimes attributing death to malaria versus other causes is not as easy as it might seem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think by anybody's reckoning, this is a significant health threat throughout much of the tropical and subtropical areas of the world.
And it is confined, generally speaking, confined to areas, those kinds of areas, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. One time actually was a significant problem in the southern parts of the United States. And it one of the things about it that seems a little bit frustrating is that these places where it's endemic, it's been that way for a very long time. It seems that the places where malaria is a problem today, most of them are the same places that it was a problem yesterday, and I think people are concerned that if we don't do something about it, that it's going to continue to be that same level of problem into the foreseeable future.
Well, I think that's certainly correct. There's in the areas of the world that were formerly very endemic for malaria, such as the South and southeastern United States and many parts of the Mediterranean and Europe and such, this was a huge health threat up until just really the decade or so after World War II. And I think in those particular areas, it was a combination of rapidly increasing standards of living and the availability of two very important new tools that actually were developed during World War II. DDT is a sprayable insecticide, and the use of chloroquine for drug treatment. And I think all those things together led to a rapid decrease of malaria in southeastern United States and eventually elimination.
Mm-hmm.
But in the big tropical areas of the world, standards of living simply have not kept up. In fact, in many areas in sub-Saharan Africa, they are less today than what they were even 20 or 30 years ago. And so there's certainly still room there for improvement, and it's certainly a huge problem in these areas.
Malaria is caused by a parasite and is spread by mosquitoes, by a particular kind of mosquito. And the method of transmission is if you have an individual who is infected, they're bitten by a mosquito, the mosquito picks up the parasite, takes it to another person who is not infected, but in the course of biting them, then that person becomes infected. So, as you say, one of the main avenues for fighting the disease has been to try to eradicate the mosquitoes. And I suppose that there are some places that that's easier than others. And then, of course, there have been some issues perhaps about what it is we use to try to kill those mosquitoes. But in some places is the issue that the idea of trying to – that you could possibly get rid of all of these mosquitoes, it's just not possible. It would be too big a task.
Yeah, I think anyone who's tried to have a backyard barbecue in suburban Maryland in August realizes that getting rid of mosquitoes just probably isn't ever going to happen. So we still have anopheline mosquitoes, which are the primary vector for malaria, throughout the United States. They're found relatively easily from California up through the Ohio Valley, even up as high as Philadelphia and New York. And yet we have no sustained transmission in the U.S. So breaking the transmission cycle is certainly possible without eliminating mosquitoes, which I think is an unrealistic goal.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so there are a variety of things that can be used to block transmission as opposed to completely eliminating the adult mosquito population.
Yeah, if there are no humans that have it, or if you can prevent it from being transmitted, then the whether you have the mosquito or not, that's not going to be the issue.
Yeah, in fact, the more one really learns and understands about the life cycle and the transmission dynamics of the malaria parasite, the more in wonder one becomes that it could ever possibly remain so entrenched in the human population. There are seemingly several avenues in which the parasite should be remarkably sensitive to interventions. But obviously, this is a very prominent parasitic infection. In fact, many people believe it's the single most dominant impact on the human genome over the last 20 to 50,000 years of evolution. Much of our blood group abnormalities and hemoglobinopathies are really a direct result as a protective effect against the falciparum malaria.
Mm-hmm. And you're thinking of something like sickle cell, for example.
Absolutely. Yes, sickle cell anemia and the thalassemias and G6PD deficiency, these are all, we consider them sort of in our practice environment today in the United States as medical abnormalities, but in reality they're adaptations to the selective pressure of malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has had a dramatic effect on the human genome.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Colonel Alan McGill, he is a physician. He is also director of the Division of Experimental Therapeutics at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C., and has done a lot of work on tropical diseases, malaria among them. And that's what we're talking about here this morning, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. There's a number of things that I want to talk about, but perhaps we get right to, I think, the thing that caught our attention and started us thinking that perhaps it would be good to have a conversation about malaria. And that is some stories that have been reported in the news just fairly recently about concerns that a particular variety of malaria, a particular strain, perhaps one of the worst ones, we have started to see in a particular place the development of resistance to one of the newer and better drugs that we have to treat it. And this is happening apparently in Cambodia, and it has to do with a drug called artemisinin. And you can correct me if my pronunciation is not right.
Oh, that was right on.
Something that is plant-derived. And apparently that, and particularly in combination with some other medicines, has been doing very well. And now we've started to see this resistance appear, and does that lead people to worry that, in fact, that could spread and suddenly something that was a good treatment would not be valuable anymore?
Well, I think that's certainly the concern. On one hand, it's a fairly complicated issue, but on the other hand, it can actually be fairly straightforward. The history of chemotherapy or the drugs that we have that are effective against the treatment of malaria really all come back to two natural products. I mean, the classic is the cinchona bark, off the Peruvian cinchona trees that was isolated back in the 1700s and 1800s. And this went for many years as a powder that was used to treat a particular type of fever. You know, recognize we didn't understand the germ theory of malaria until 1880 when a French army doctor discovered the malaria parasite in the blood of patients. So prior to that point in time, people just treated fevers, not really malaria. But the what we now recognize as malaria did have a distinctive fever pattern and clinical picture. And this really translated into the drug quinine, which was isolated in and produced in 1820, and then ultimately to a large family of drugs that are derivatives of quinine in one form or another. And, of course, the most prominent there is chloroquine.
Mm-hmm.
And chloroquine, you could call the home run hitter of malaria drugs, introduced during World War II and broadly introduced in the late 40s and 50s as part of a global elimination and eradication campaign at the time. Everybody thought things were wonderful until the first reports of resistance or therapeutic failure occurred in the late 1950s, both in the same place where we're seeing the issues today on the Cambodian-Thai border, as well as in another location in Southern America. So this spread worldwide, and today, you know, really chloroquine is no longer considered a useful tool in the control of malaria. It's still widely used for a variety of reasons in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's not going to be a tool that's going to eliminate malaria. And then in the 1980s, the Chinese government basically embarked on a big drug discovery program, and from that came another class of drugs from a plant called the sweet wormwood. And this is Artemisia compounds, or Artemisia annua, and these are variously known as Qinghao Su compounds or the artemisinins. And there's probably a half a dozen or so of these in common use today. And they do represent the backbone of the current therapies that are being used worldwide. We refer to these as artemisinin combination treatments, or ACTs, because it's really a partner drug. You start off with an artemisinin compound like artesunate, and you pair it up with a long-acting drug like mefloquine or amidiaquine or lumefantrine. And it's that 1-2 punch that's extremely effective at eliminating the parasite and also, we think, very effective at preventing the emergence of resistance. So we certainly don't want to see what happened with chloroquine to happen again with artemisinin.
Mm. How long did it take for chloroquine and the quinine-related drugs to get to the point where they weren't effective anymore?
Well, the actual number of years, probably only about 15 years or so, say, mm-hmm. So from 1945 to 1960. What that really, though, tells you is that this drug was used theoretically by the kiloton. I mean, just massive quantities were used as single drug therapy in many, many locations of the world. I think what's remarkable is that resistance didn't occur sooner or in more locations. So we currently think that the resistance to these drugs is actually not that frequent of an event. And when it occurs under intense drug pressure, and then it's selected out by continued use of the drug and then spread by people from location to location. So from these first emergences around 1960 until the drug really had entered sub-Saharan Africa in particular, and by the late 80s and certainly the early 90s, the drug was largely no longer effective in the areas of the world which needed it most.
Hmm. Was that a result of the widespread use of chloroquine as a preventive, that the prophylactic use, that is, people who were going to be in areas or lived in areas where malaria was endemic were taking chloroquine, not because they had malaria, but to try to prevent them from getting malaria? It seems that level of use is going to more you're going to see the problem of resistance develop much more quickly if you've got that level of use.
Well, I certainly heard that before, but I think that's a common misconception. I mean, the numbers of people who live in areas where there isn't malaria and would take a pill to protect them from malaria when they're traveling, this could be short-term tourists, Peace Corps volunteers, long-term workers, military. I mean, there's any number of folks who take prophylaxis. But the actual numbers and amount of drug use there is really just a fraction of a percent compared to the literally hundreds of thousands or millions of people who take chloroquine on almost on a weekly or monthly basis for episodes of fever. So, and generally what happens, people do take their medicine, they travel in these areas, and they continue to take their medicine when they come back. They don't get malaria, and so there's no real possibility that the parasites are transmitted to another person.
Oh, I suppose then perhaps the issue here is just that malaria is so widespread, there's so much of it, and this was the medicine we have, and it worked well, so we gave a lot of it out.
Well, absolutely, and this was given as a mass drug administration in many areas, and in a couple of areas it was actually added to table salt in the sense that if you just continued to give the drug to people, eventually parasites would burn themselves out of the population. This actually worked in many areas, but obviously led to resistance. I think the settings, I mean, you can imagine it's sort of intuitive that if nobody ever gets treated, resistance doesn't occur. So areas that are really poorly served by healthcare and really have no access to medicines, that's really not the place where we see resistance. It's other areas of the world, like, say, Latin America or Southeast Asia, in which there actually are very well-developed healthcare systems. There are marginalized populations that sometimes don't have access, but in general, you know, febrile patients can get diagnosed and treated. And the particular area historically and currently in Cambodia is an area around Palin, which is known to be an area in which there's lots of movement of peoples. These are well-known gem mining areas and ruby mining areas, so people will come from all over the adjoining areas to work in the mines for periods of time to make money. They don't want to be sick when they work, so they'll actually take medications. So it's this, I think, very frequent, high-intensity use of drugs in these areas where there is transmission. I think this is the setup for resistance.
Mm-hmm. And that same the same kind of pattern that we saw with the resistance to chloroquine, that same thing is happening now as far as the artemisinin is concerned.
Yes, and I'm sure people will say, well, it's not exactly the same, and that's probably true. But I think in the big picture, you know, the same sorts of phenomenon, people moving in from areas where there is no malaria into an area where there is some transmission, there's some intense short-term use of drugs, and people moving back and forth. I think that's a keen setup for this.
We have a couple of callers. We'll talk with someone first in Urbana, line number one.
Hi.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that the elimination of mosquitoes is, you know, not realistic, it's not possible. What would you, how important is just the reduction of the number of vector mosquitoes?
Well, I think it actually is quite important. And the issue is you don't want mosquitoes to bite you, and you don't want the human reservoir to actually contain lots of circulating parasites. So one of the key concepts in elimination prevention or eradication is this concept of integrated control. So, for example, case management, you have sick people and you diagnose them and treat them with drugs, but you also try to get everybody to sleep under bed nets. And bed nets have been shown to be very effective at preventing malaria attacks and reducing the overall numbers. And then if you look in certain areas, and a lot of this depends very much on mosquito behavior, and mosquitoes may all look the same, but they don't behave the same around the world. And so, for example, the classic indoor residual spray with DDT or other long-acting insecticides, in certain areas of the world where mosquitoes land on the wall after a blood meal, can be very effective at killing those infected mosquitoes and thus interrupting transmission. So I think the targeted vector approaches that really look at the epidemiology and the behavior of mosquitoes in the area are quite important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, yeah, certainly by suggesting that we were never going to get rid of the mosquitoes, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that one would just give up on the idea of trying to control them. And I think certainly there you pointed to the two things that are being done, have been done, and are very cost effective, particularly the distribution of nets, mosquito nets, that people put over their beds to cover them when they're sleeping, so that there is a physical barrier between the mosquitoes and them. So, and the hope is that while people are sleeping, they're not going to be bitten by the mosquitoes. And by the same token, by using some limited and judicious use of insecticide, spraying them inside people's homes, that they can also do something to knock down the numbers of mosquitoes, so that at the very least you can reduce, if you can reduce the chances that someone will be bitten, then you can reduce the chances that they will become infected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk with someone else, and this is someone in Belgium, Illinois, not too far from us. Line number four, hello.
Good morning. You did mention the thing that I was going to bring up, the bed netting, because the fact that Anopheles mosquitoes mainly feed at night, so that's why you want to use them above beds. Also, the aspect is where you're working at Walter Reed Hospital. Walter Reed was famous for doing work with yellow fever. Is yellow fever associated with mosquitoes?
Well, the second part of that first, absolutely, yellow fever is a viral infection transmitted by Aedes aegypti or other Aedes biting insects in the tropics. So absolutely a mosquito-borne disease. The issue with anophelines and bed nets is very, very true, and the primary vector in Africa, which is Anopheles gambiae, is a sort of in-the-middle-of-the-night feeder in most cases. And so bed nets in that area, actually, I think, are going to be very, very effective.
Also, if I might point out that mosquitoes are a very, very important food source for many other animals. So the getting rid of all the mosquitoes would have a biological effect on other animals that would be probably very important to look into. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And just, again, to sort of make one more point about the bed nets, I think that some people would argue that this was something that would go a long way toward reducing the incidence of the disease, which is, in certain parts of the country, certain parts of the world, very widespread, and both is linked to poverty, in a couple of ways. It's the cause of and the result of poverty, but for a relatively small amount of money, you can distribute these things. You can, and certainly people have organized efforts simply to give them away, give people these things. So for a pretty small amount of money, you can actually get a very significant positive benefit.
Well, I think certainly it's possible, and the amount of money for the net itself on a global scale is relatively small, I think. There are some very interesting aspects, though. When I worked in Latin America in the Amazon basin for several years, the primary vector of human malaria in that region is something called Anopheles darlingi. And Anopheles darlingi was very annoying in the sense that it did a lot of its biting in the early evening before people went to bed. And it also tended to not stay in the household but then fly back out into the trees, if you will. So bed nets in the Amazon are not as effective, and it's just because of people and their behaviors. They're not going to go under a bed net at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. In fact, we found one of the most interesting protective features was actually a television. So people would actually buy a television and put it in the center of a village, and they would charge a very, very small fee for people to come, and they would sit on rows, if you will, and watch TV. Well, this would bring them away from the vegetation on the periphery and into a sort of a well-lit area in the center. Kind of interesting that it actually proved to be a protective against malaria.
Hmm.
And then in the real world, it's all about people and their behaviors. And people will often not use bed nets to prevent malaria, but they will use bed nets to prevent mosquito bites because of the overwhelming annoyance factor of bug bites. And we all can relate to that. And so there really has to be a fairly strong educational component and follow-up to the effective use of bed nets. I think just distributing large numbers without a program to go with it, both educational and follow-up and such, certainly is not as effective as we'd like it to be.
We are at our midpoint here, and I'd like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Alan McGill. He's director of the Division of Experimental Therapeutics at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C. He has worked on vaccines, diagnostics, drugs directed against the tropical diseases malaria and leishmaniasis. He's lived and worked in South America, Africa, Southeast Asia. He served as head of parasitology at the Naval Medical Research Center Detachment in Lima, Peru. He's an active member of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. He's also president-elect of the International Society of Travel Medicine. We're talking about malaria, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What is the possibility, do you think, that at some point there will be a vaccine for malaria?
Well, that, I guess, is the holy grail, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I spent the first part of my career in the Army here working on malaria vaccines and was part of the original team working on the RTSS vaccine, which we subsequently partnered with GSK and is, I think, by everyone's viewpoint, probably the most advanced vaccine in clinical testing today. But there are several other vaccine approaches in the works, and I think this is a personal view, which I'm sure is not shared by others, but the reality is we're still a ways away from a vaccine, and whether this is 5 years or 20 years, I think, remains to be seen. One of the biggest things I've noticed in the last 15 or 20 years, though, is the tremendous increase in resources that are available to people who want to work in this area. Certainly 15 or 20 years ago, we at the Walter Reed Institute here were amongst the very few actually working on these areas. And there were certainly some other smaller groups working on it, but the degree of resources available made available through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other governmental organizations now is truly staggering compared to what it was 15 years ago. And I think there's some hope that if the appropriate resources and the appropriate brain power are put on these projects, that we may actually see the vaccines being developed. But this is not a quick process. I mean, everybody looks for a result in 2 to 3 years, especially government funders. But this is a long haul. This is a 15 or 20-year sustained effort by large teams of really committed people. Mm-hmm. And so we'll wait and see what happens.
I have read some articles and not particularly understood them very well, but maybe you can explain in a way that can be clear to somebody like me who doesn't have the sort of background that you do, that people are looking at the parasite and its life cycle and what happens to the parasite once it gets into the human body, and asking this question, is it possible to interfere in some way with the life cycle of the parasite so that perhaps a person will become infected, but then once it gets into the body, it's disrupted to the extent that it can't then be transmitted on to somebody else. Do I have that right?
Well, certainly, yes. In the big scope, that's what it's all about, is transmission interruption or transmission blocking when you try to take this to elimination or control. I mean, a sick person in front of you, you want to treat that person and make sure they get well and they don't die from the disease. That's a sort of a primary first-line goal. In working in these areas, especially doing malaria research, if you're not also actually taking care of people and making sure they get well, then you wear out your welcome very quickly in these areas. Whether it's drugs or vaccines, that is certainly a goal, is to interrupt transmission. In the case of using drugs, you actually disrupt the parasite development in the liver so that it doesn't actually get into the bloodstream at all. And some of the most promising vaccine approaches are using what we would call a whole cell approach, in which we actually look at the parasite that's injected into the human being by a mosquito, which is called a sporozoite, and they're looking at genetic approaches to attenuate that parasite, or by actually using something like radiation to actually attenuate the parasite. So the parasite itself actually is weakened, it's attenuated, and so when it infects the human being, it goes through a partial development cycle in the liver but can't complete that cycle and go into cause a human infection.
Do you think that during your lifetime, my lifetime, our lifetime, that it's possible that we will see the defeat of malaria and see it wiped out? Or is this, given that we know that malaria has been something that's troubled human beings for a long time, should one think that it's possible that the day will come when there just isn't any more malaria?
Oh, I think it's clearly possible. Now, that where people will disagree and have some fairly energetic discussions is the concept of, well, what's the probability and can we actually do it with the tools we have? And that's a very prominent and a really a very useful discussion. With the drugs we have, with the bed nets, with all the things we have, can we actually interrupt this? Is this merely a lack of will or a lack of resources, or do we really not have the tool? You know, that's, again, an energetic discussion. You'll get a lot of viewpoints. I think the reality, though, is we have eliminated malaria in many areas of the world, Europe, North America, and actually many other places as well. And we did it with tools that actually aren't even as good as we have today. And so part of this is all about the political will and the ability to actually raise people's standard of living. In the United States, the incidence of malaria was rapidly declining from about the mid-20s up until the mid-40s. And this was long before we introduced DDT and chloroquine. And part of this was people actually building houses, people actually putting screens up, people having indoor toilets as opposed to outhouses. There's a host of things that went on to really get a lot of control, and people would say, well, it was just the DDT and chloroquine were just the knockout punches. Malaria was already reeling, so to speak, and when you came in with those tools, you were able to knock it out. And I think in many areas of, especially sub-Saharan Africa, I think that's a very valid concern, is that the healthcare systems and the standards of living would need to advance considerably before the medical tools we have would actually be effective in elimination or eradication.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning is Colonel Alan McGill. He's a physician. He's director of the Division of Experimental Therapeutics at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C., has done a lot of work on tropical disease, and we're talking this morning about malaria. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Not surprising, I'm sure, that someone who was a military physician would be concerned about tropical disease like malaria, because soldiers do go into places where there is malaria, and what you want to do is make sure that they don't get sick. You don't want people with malaria; they're not going to be able to do their jobs. What way does the military approach this problem for people who are going to serve in places where malaria is endemic?
Well, certainly the history of all Western militaries, and certainly the U.S. military and malaria is a pretty rich one, goes back, you know, well over 100 years. And certainly the latest or the last two big episodes with this were certainly in World War II, in which literally millions of non-immune soldiers were in these lengthy campaigns in the Pacific in very malarious areas. And then, of course, in the Vietnam conflict, there was another big problem there as well. Since Vietnam, we have not been engaged in conflicts, per se, in heavily malarious areas. There certainly is malaria transmitted in Afghanistan, and it's a fairly low-level problem, but a real one for especially certain areas. And I think the basic attitude in the military is always about prevention. I mean, we certainly want to treat sick people, but we're much happier making sure people don't get sick, and that's for obvious reasons. Sick people can't actually do their mission and become a medical casualty, so to speak. So the military, the Walter Reed Group in particular, has had a long, long history in vaccine development. Many of the vaccines that are used today originated here at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And then in malaria, we have a big vaccine program as well, but we've also had a big drug program. And to be honest with you, all of the drugs that are out there today are either directly from the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, or at least the Walter Reed Group had some impact and played some role in the development of the drugs. The exception to that is, of course, the artemisinin compounds, which did come out of the Chinese government and have largely been developed outside of the Western sphere in the last 20 years or so. And that, again, remains a key issue, and it's one of the reasons why many people like myself who are very interested in tropical medicine and tropical disease have found a rewarding professional career in the military, and there are many of us like this. And the efforts that we have really are very much dual use. For example, we can't do any of our clinical trials or any of our work in Kansas. That's one of my favorite phrases. Well, there's no malaria in Kansas last time I checked. So we have to do all of our work in overseas locations where there is malaria. So, for example, we have a big laboratory in western Kenya. We have laboratories in Egypt, in Peru, in Thailand, and we have many collaborators in many locations. And many of us have lived and worked in these areas for years, and our view is long-term staying power. We are there as guests of the host nation, and essentially everything we do needs to be of some benefit to the host nation and the host nation populations. Otherwise, we would certainly not be welcome guests. So we certainly have a military hat on. That is who pays our bills, and we're our primary target population is the American military personnel, and to prevent them from getting malaria. But we certainly cannot do our job without paying just as much attention to the host nation and the endemic area problems. And I think, in fact, the last, you know, the last 10 years or so, many of us feel that perhaps that is actually going to become one of the primary efforts. In fact, the best way to protect an American soldier from getting malaria is to eliminate malaria. And so maybe some of the resources and talent that the American government and the American military possess could equally be applied to these global problems, and we'd solve the same problem, but perhaps in somewhat of a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly people make the argument that it also would contribute to goodwill towards the United States around the world. If the United States could be seen to be making a contribution to dealing with this particular problem, which is a very serious health problem in large parts of the world.
Absolutely. And, of course, there has been a big footprint in malaria with the President's Malaria Initiative, which was started by President Bush several years ago. And that is a counterpart to the PEPFAR program, which is the distribution of antiretroviral drugs in sub-Saharan Africa. So these are really big programs. They're not directly related to what we do at Walter Reed, but we consider ourselves the pharmaceutical company, if you will, or the development company that helps supply the tools for these other big programs that can then distribute those tools in these endemic areas.
Well, just to go back to the treatment or the preventive effort, then if you have service people who are going to be going into those places where you know that there is malaria, now what is it that you're giving to them, or what is it that they're taking to try to reduce their possibility, or maybe eliminate the possibility that they're going to end up with malaria as a result of being in the place where the disease is common?
Well, we certainly distribute pills that people take for chemoprophylaxis, but really would like to see that as only one part of a broad prevention strategy. And the first layer here is what we call awareness or education. There really does need to be a strong educational effort directed both at the soldiers, their commanders, and the medical units to understand about malaria in these endemic areas, how to prevent it, and how to treat it. So that's key. The second layer is what we call personal protective measures, which is all the things we do to prevent mosquitoes and sandflies and ticks from biting people. In general, I think it's a standard rule to say that all mosquito bites in the tropics may not necessarily be a good thing. And so we try to prevent those with insecticide-impregnated uniforms, bed nets, perimeter controls, and this very basic preventive medicine. And the third level, after all of that, is individual chemoprophylaxis. So there are three drugs that are routinely used that are approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which we use for malaria prophylaxis in soldiers. That's doxycycline, atovaquone proguanil, which is a brand name for Malarone, and then also mefloquine. So any of those three drugs are fairly equally efficacious, and it depends on the nature of the deployment, the duration, locations, and such as to which one is picked. So hopefully putting all those together, soldiers and any other non-immune traveler would actually be very well protected from malaria. And in fact, they are. The problem always comes in trying to make sure that large numbers receive all of those things on a timely basis.
All right. Let's talk with someone here listening in Urbana. This is a caller on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. Yes, Colonel, thank you for your work. It's an uphill battle. When I was a military brat, and I lived in Okinawa in 1958 through 1961, and when we lived off base, we were my parents gave us, I was like 8 or 9 years old then, at the beginning, and we basically slept under nets, bed nets, and when we moved on base a couple years later, they fogged the base with DDT, and my mother was smart enough to keep us inside. But I noticed, I know they don't do that anymore, but I know that, but when I was in the military, I was in Southeast Asia along the Cambodian border, and we were given the prophylaxis, and I didn't sleep under nets very much because I was out in a recon unit, so I was exposed. I think I was exposed. I mean, I was never diagnosed with it. But I'm wondering about the latency period on that. If you're exposed to that when you're younger, like in your 20s, does it return when you're in your 50s? I'm 59 now. You know anything about that?
Well, sure. There are actually five species of malaria that cause human malaria today. And there's three of them are what we call non-relapsing forms. Okay. By far and away, the biggest one there is falciparum malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And falciparum malaria does not have a latent phase in human infection, so it doesn't persist.
Okay.
So once you're exposed and once the parasites sort of burn out through your bloodstream, then you're no longer at any risk for infection.
Yeah.
Now, Plasmodium vivax, which is the other very important human pathogen, does have a stage in the liver that remains latent or asleep, sometimes for days, weeks, or even a year or so. But even then, I would say, and this is subject to, again, as usual, a little debate, but by and large, about a year to 2 years. Once you've been out after 2 years, we don't see any kind of relapse in that setting.
Okay.
So for someone like you whose exposure was really remote decades ago, I would say I think you're out of the woods. I don't think you've got any parasites.
Well, it makes me feel good. But I was going to ask you something. I had read something about late last year there was a book critical of the Clinton Foundation and the and Gates Foundation, who do a lot of malarial things in Asia and Africa. And the guy said, you know, the medicinal end is admirable to pursue, you know, a cure or a vaccine for it. But he said basically people should spend a lot of time, like you said, educating people there, you know, indigenous people that used mosquito nets and use prophylaxis when there's an outbreak. And could you comment on that? And I want to thank you for all your work. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I think when the Bill and Melinda Gates first issued the challenge or call, if you will, for elimination and eradication in the fall of 2007, I think it's safe to say that has sparked as energetic a debate as we've seen in the community in a long time. And I say that not tongue-in-cheek, because I don't feel there is a wrong answer here. I think this is an area that's just open to lots of good discussion, and people's experiences vary from around the world. I know a lot of my experiences have been in the Amazon basin, in which I think the transmission dynamics and the types of vectors are such that I think control and elimination really are possible. In certain areas of Africa where there's different epidemiology and different vectors, you know, I think it's safe to say that the jury is still out. And a lot of this comes down to, do you want to just live with the parasite, or do you actually want to get rid of it? So if your goal is elimination or eradication, then I don't think there's any question we will need drugs and diagnostics and vaccines to accomplish that, as well as bed nets and other vector measures. If your goal is just to establish an equilibrium, if you will, and to live with the parasite, maybe there is a different strategy there. I'm not convinced. I think this is a human pathogen. I think the world would be a better place without the Plasmodium malaria parasite. Whether we can actually get there, I think, is the area for debate.
Well, just to return to this insecticide question for a while, you talked earlier about the fact that at one point large amounts of DDT were used to try to kill the mosquitoes, and that was successful. But as people will recall, there was real concern about environmental impact of DDT. Now, though, in particular parts of the world, is the trade-off there enough so that we would say using something like DDT is desirable, appropriate, particularly if it's perhaps a more targeted kind of use? Or do we need, in addition to all of this, do we need better, more environmentally friendly insecticides?
Well, I think the answer to that is all of the above. And I would say that because, like many folks of my generation, I sort of grew up in the Rachel Carson Silent Spring era of the green revolutions in the 70s, if you will, in the way we think. And interestingly, when you go back and look at the history of DDT, I truly believe that the problem at that point in time was not the use of DDT in backpack sprayers to control malaria. The problem was the use of literally, again, tons of DDT as an agricultural pesticide. And we know now that there's clearly environmental damage when we use DDT in that fashion. I had the privilege to sit on an Institute of Medicine panel a few years ago looking at the health effects and the controversy surrounding DDT. And I was a little bit surprised to learn that the health effects of DDT on humans have really never been substantiated. Now, that's a very emotional issue amongst some people, and there's certainly a group that feel that that's not indeed the case. But from a particular sort of a rational scientific point of view, I don't think DDT is a toxic chemical for human beings. Now, it certainly is for insects, and it certainly is in the environment. So I think it's with most things, it's how you use it. So very controlled use in backpack sprayers in areas of the world where the behavior of mosquitoes actually makes the use of any insecticide, including DDT, useful. I think and the South Africans have shown this, and many others have shown that this is a very effective intervention. The downside is that it's fairly expensive and fairly technical in the sense that you've got to train teams. You do have to be very careful in how it's used and disposed and such. And I think there is a valid concern that if you use it anywhere, it means somebody actually has to make it. So there has to be factories that produce DDT, and there's a great fear amongst folks that the DDT will actually be siphoned off, if you will, and be used as an agricultural pesticide because it's such a good one. And so the critics of the use of DDT will say that any use is going to be somehow subverted and you'll have the unattractive aspects of DDT to follow. And I will freely admit, I think there's some truth to that.
We just have about 2 minutes. If you can, in that amount of time, you talked earlier about for a long time the quinine and quinine derivatives were used to treat malaria, and then we started to see the development of resistance particularly to chloroquine, which was very, very widely used. Then we had the artemisinins coming out of China that proved to be very good, and then now, though, we're starting to see some emergence of resistance to them. How much longer do we have on those, and is there something that's waiting in the wings that we can start to use?
Well, the second part of that question is pretty easy. There is nothing waiting in the wings. Drug development is a long and costly process, and I'm fairly familiar with it now, and I don't believe there's any easy or obvious replacement for the artemisinins that's in the short term. What can be done and needs to be done now is that artemisinins, if they're used by themselves in what we call monotherapy, just individual use of the drug, are actually surprisingly not effective. They have such a short half-life, you get tremendous rapid killing, but to really get a cure with these drugs is actually not that easy. That's why they have to be partnered with a long-acting drug. Now, unfortunately, there are many, many manufacturers of these drugs around the world today, and there's many groups out there, many companies still manufacturing what we call monotherapies and then marketing and distributing those throughout the malarious world. I personally believe that this is untenable, and it just really has to stop because continued use of the single agent inevitably is going to lead to resistance. I think that's the natural history of it. So this is an area where governments, doctors aren't going to solve this. Governments, politicians, lawyers, World Trade Organization, WHO really need to step in and do the best job we can at eliminating or at least greatly minimizing the use of these monotherapies and then flooding the markets with what we call fixed-dose combination therapies, a single pill that has both drugs in it, so that an individual has no choice but to take an effective therapy when they treat themselves.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Colonel Alan McGill. He's a physician, director of the Division of Experimental Therapeutics at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C. Quite a lot of experience in working in the area of tropical medicine. He is an active member of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene and also president-elect of the International Society of Travel Medicine. Dr. McGill, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. It's a delight.